Which beast would you prefer to be in D&D if you had to be one? If you had to live that life with those mechanics?
Some of them, like monstrosity, I could have an answer for you. Aberration, I could have an answer for you. But the
Yeah.
beasts are so just like, I don't know.
Here's the thing. I would want to say something along the words like lines would just be like a giant dire wolf or like a large version of a regular beast. But then I feel
Right.
like I'm getting into furry territory and I don't really want to do
Just
that.
how, Megan, how quickly you can derail something.
I feel like we haven't been on an episode in a long time and you've forgotten what it's like.
This is the
So.
cold open, and you immediately start talking about furries. Immediately.
I'm
That's
sleep deprived.
Adam tried to answer the question and went furries.
I did.
I'll tell you, my honest answer is when I was 5 years old, I would stomp around like a tyrannosaurus. So that's got to be my answer.
I was gonna say
Right,
Adam
right,
has to
right,
say
right. Okay.
dinosaur. Like has to say dinosaur. So, what about you, Terry? What would you be now that I've ruined it for you?
I don't know. I feel like I would just, I think I always wanted to be a lion. I think I would just be, is that
Aww.
okay? Is that just super douchey?
That's
No,
perfectly
you're
fine.
a Lannister. That's what it makes sense.
It
I
really
am.
does. Yeah. Did you know that the costume of the lion in Wizard of Oz is actual real lion skin?
What the fuck?
That's dark.
You're welcome.
That's the second thing
Buckle up, everyone. It's going to be a hell of an episode.
that you said.
Welcome to the It's a Mimic podcast, where you never know what you're going to get.
Welcome to another It's a Mimic episode, where we continue our conversation on monsters in Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition. I'm Megan, and with me today are Terry and Adam, and this episode is called The Nature of the Beasts.
In this episode of the It's a Mimic podcast, this panel of Dungeon Masters is going to tap into their animal side and discuss the many different kinds of beasts in 5th edition.
There is a crazy amount of beasts and animals in 5th ed, and each one is generally different from the others. So it's going to be impossible to cover them all in one episode. Yet most of them are exactly what you'd expect and don't really deserve a whole spotlight. So before we get started on our long list of types of beasts, I wanted to ask you guys, what pets have you owned in your lifetime?
Oh, yeah. Are we rolling for this?
Yeah, let's roll initiative.
All right.
16.
Oh, 20. 20 right off the bat.
No, oh, that's
it
right
took
off
you
the
all
bat.
year to get here, Terry.
I think I maybe had one last time we recorded together, actually. I remember exclaiming this to you recently. Okay. For me, I'll give them to you in order. I'll give them to you in order right now. Started off, hamster, 2 years old. I thought it was going mentally, like mentally ill or something. It was rocking around. Turns out, apparently, that just happens to hamsters and their heartbeat slows down or whatever, and they do weird things like that. Anyway, had to throw it out so that was dead. Two guinea pigs, two cats, two Shih Tzu dogs, but I feel like they weren't really mine. My mom just got them when she was like empty nesting or whatever when we left home. And I think that's it. I think that's it. I think that's me.
Well, and you have one now.
Oh, am I? Yes, I have a dog now. Yeah, sorry. I thought I was just thinking growing up,
yeah,
up until adulthood.
Oh, I guess that's me next.
That's
my
it.
My parents were big on no messes in the house, so we had rabbits that had to live outside, which means my dad ended up building from scratch a massive pen, and like he heated it and shit because it was, you know, Canadian winter, and we just let rabbits live outside. And then nothing until I was in my mid-20s and I got an aquarium. And then it was aquarium fish and freshwater fish and lobsters and snails and shrimp and
You had lobsters?
Yeah, like little itty bitty like aquarium lobsters.
I've wanted to eat your last three pets. Like I'm not like no cap.
Let me see. We had frogs in there as well. I started to keep like the plants in there don't count, but it was live plants as well. And then I've had a variety of lizards, from mountain horned dragons to geckos to anoles to lots of different lizards. So now I have three leopard geckos.
Well, that's cute.
Man.
I didn't have a plethora of animals. We had our family cat growing up, And then we had the one because my mom had too many children, so didn't want too many animals in the house.
Fair.
And then when I became an adult, I had leopard geckos because my partner at the time was allergic to things with fur, so I couldn't get a pet animal. So.
Fuck people.
And then I moved.
It's not your fault, but fuck you for what a stupid fucking thing.
So, and then when I moved out, and now that I'm on my own, I have Momo, who is my spirit cat, who just is my right hand man.
You've overcompensated on
fur. He has so much fur. I talk about my cat a lot on this podcast, but he's part Maine Coon, so he's the size of my chest and has more fur than anybody deserves to have. So.
I think he's technically a puma. Is that correct?
A puma? But his paws are the size of my hands, so he's a delightful young man.
All right.
I have met both your dog, Terry, and your cat, Megan, and I have to say, my leopard geckos are far more vicious than either of your animals, which is hilarious.
Yeah. Oh, my... Oh Lord. Yeah, no, my leopard geckos that I had were also like very, very feisty, and I couldn't even imagine putting them in a room with a cat or another animal. But anyways, let's get to list now of beasties that we're gonna talk about today. But first, let's have an info break.
We've previously covered quite a bit in our discussion on monsters in 5th edition. For all of those episodes and more, you can follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and dozens of other podcast apps. If you would like to support us, you can donate through the website, check out our store, or join our Patreon and get access to other episodes and series. If you would like to pay for some ad space on It's a Mimic, or just send a shout out to a friend, please reach out to us through our email and website that are listed in the show notes below.
This week on the It's a Mimic podcast, everything is different now. We finally have a new editing computer. Thank God. No, not thank God. Thank the patrons. You guys, I mean, thank God too. It doesn't hurt. But thank you to all of the patrons. You guys have made this finally a reality. And so we are up and running. It's taken us a couple of weeks to get here because every time that we take one step forward, it's been two steps back. But the good news is that we managed to rescue all of the files off of the old dying computer. We're all set up and ready to go. And we're not just going to get back to our regularly scheduled program. We're going to make up for the last couple of weeks as well. So what that means is that on the public channel, we're going to have the regular podcast plus a couple of bonus episodes for the ones that we missed. And then L5R, Undead, couple of mailbags. On the Patreon, we're going to have Campaign Builder, Legend Lore, and Pantheon. These are all going to be dropping pretty much rapid fire over the next couple of weeks, just to get us caught back up to where we wanted to be originally, before all the technical setbacks. So, there's a lot coming. Buckle up. It's a good time to be listening to It's a Mimic, because there's about to be an onslaught of episodes. But for now, let's get back to this one.
Alright, so just before we start chatting about a few different kinds of beasts, let me just take a moment to remind folks of what a beast in the accordance of the Monsters Manual is for 5th edition D&D. Beasts are considered to be non-humanoid beings that naturally occur within the ecosystem of the fantasy realm. That's kind of a weird way of saying that beasts can be weird and magical, but they are as naturally occurring as possible within the realm of fantasy, if that makes sense. So that can include anything from basic animals all the way up to dinosaurs and also just giant or larger version of animals. As I mentioned, they can be inherently magical if the land and ecosystem require them to be, but that is not always the case. But as a whole, they tend to just not really have a society of their own and not necessarily intelligent and not necessarily speak languages. So that is the easiest way I can describe beasts.
Yeah, they're also our favorite.
Yeah, most people
get the best animals
with the monstrosities, right? Mm-hmm. But monstrosities are made by wizards, and everything else comes from somewhere else, right? So,
yeah, either created or morphed or changed or what have you. Beasts are very specific to; they are naturally occurring within the ecosystem.
Okay, so we're going to run through, I guess, a series of types of beasts, not necessarily specific creatures, but different types of beasts that we would see kind of occurring in the natural world. And we can talk about some behaviors, some characteristics, some lairs, nests, environments, things like that. So I guess really emphasize the exploration pillar in a lot of ways. So should we roll for it, I suppose?
Yeah.
16?
I got a 5.
I beat you with a 6.
No.
Oh, okay, right. So me first?
Yeah. So just to start off, I assume that most people know what an animal is at this point. So this is not going to be a deep dive into like what is a frog.
Right.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. These are going to be, we got a long ass list today, right? So this this should be an opportunity for each of us to maybe give DMs who use beasts a little inspiration like that. Hey, don't forget to do this, right? Because there's honestly, beasts who do not deserve 2 episodes. So we're slamming them all into one. So,
but yeah, I feel like they're the funnest to talk about. That's all. Like, I would like to have another episode, but it's too much. You're right. You're right.
We're gonna hyper focus on like a wolf, right?
Yeah, that's it.
I could talk about a wolf for hours, but I mean, nobody wants to listen to that shit.
No, I don't want to listen to that.
Yeah. So, well, let's hit a couple of predators first, then. So, first of all, thinking of predator animals that chase. When I think of predator animals that chase, I think of them still relying on the element of surprise. They're going to try and approach the prey and get as close as possible before they're initiating any kind of sprint. So in combat, this could look like you would have that when you bring out your battle map, you may have your party on the battle map, but the predators may not enter until their turn on round one. So you may have 2 or 3 turns where the players, there's no enemy yet, but you've taken them into initiative because you know that that attack is about to happen.
Yeah, I think when we're taking in like predators that chase into consideration, if we're thinking about things like their lairs or what their nests might look like, I feel like you can go one of two ways. One, they're very like quickly put together because they travel a lot. They're not really hunkered down in one place all at once. They just kind of like move from place to place depending on where the hunt is. Or you can go the other way where it has a very, very strong nest and like resting place where it exists and has its own life and where it keeps its goods and its bones and things like that. You can kind of go one way or the other with these types.
It's interesting because I mean, you think about things that chase, right? And in North America, I'm thinking bears, wolves, coyotes, like these are the things that chase you.
Mm-hmm.
And just to your point, Megan, they have little dens that they stick with, but they range so far, right? They've got territories that they go around, and then there's like home base, which might take them a few days to get back to, right?
Mm-hmm.
For me, the big thing that sticks out to me anytime that I DM with a predator that's going to chase the party is that they've got an increased movement speed because that's one of their primary natural advantages. Otherwise, they wouldn't chase, they would ambush. So I like going a little bit above the recommended CR, and that should make for a memorable chase when they bust out of the foliage and start chasing the party. Normally, the party's the one chasing. But if you have a dire bear come out, then they should run.
Yeah, absolutely. But there may be some differences then with predators that ambush. So we're thinking about predators that ambush. Those predators know that sources of water are going to be a natural advantage to them. So what does that mean for when your party is at water crossings? What does it mean where if they decide that they're going to camp by a water spot? What kind of encounters are going to come from that? Because sometimes we'll think, you'll start to think like humanoid NPCs or other types of encounters. It's rare that you'll think maybe you've just been stalked and that's when an ambush is going to go off.
Yeah. They're going to have pack tactics of some kind too, right? Stats-wise,
yeah.
They're going to be the ones that benefit from having a bunch of them around in one place. And you feel like, I feel like as a group, if you're being a traveling group, you would feel you are being hunted, but you wouldn't know by what at some point. And then the ambush will always be some kind of a surprise. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, the thing that I always think about is when they ambush, they got to ambush from somewhere. And as much as like water's a great idea for crocodiles because it can blend in, like you don't see them moving beneath the surface, a lot of the land animals have to rely on camouflage and stealth. Most beasts don't have dark vision. So you got to remember that your dim light rules exist and think about boosting up their stealth bonuses to reflect their tactics. I have no problem giving camouflage or stealth bonuses above and beyond what the stat block says if it makes sense for that animal.
Yeah, agreed. And I'm getting better at doing that more and more. I'll bump the CRs up and change some stats just because it makes sense. What about for prey creatures then? When I think of prey creatures, I think that, well, the common prey creatures we would have in D&D would be deer, elk, maybe dire versions of these. Those are the ones that most people will go to. And what I was thinking of with behaviors is that depending on when your campaign takes place, if it happens to be in the autumn, these animals, oh, sorry, when do animals go into the rut? Autumn, right?
Yeah, though they hibernate for the winter, right? So
yeah, that's the point I was making. So behavior will change with things like that. So you may find that those types of prey creatures may be more aggressive at times like that. So behavior could depend on the season.
I just realized I had myself on mute. Took me a minute to find the unmute button.
First day, Megan, or what?
I try to do that to help folks, like, and not like make my background noise an issue.
It's difficult with these quick fire answers. I know it's harder to get into your flow. You're doing great.
Don't. That feels patronizing, but that's fine. Anyways,
Megan, I did it. I did it just to mess with you. I did it just to mess with you, just to see what you did.
You're doing fantastic.
Stop it! I hate you. Hey, dying to fire, fall up the stairs. No, for prey creatures, again, they can be anything that is going to get eaten by something else, right? So I always feel like you can remember that you as an adventuring group could also be preying on these creatures, such as you're wandering in the wilderness and want to go find mice and rats and like things like that to kind of take home with you and like be able to cook and that, you know, that kind of thing. So when we think creatures or beasties, we always think of things that are going to hurt us and kill us. I think that the prey creature is a good one to remember as a DM, that you can put them in your campaign so that you can utilize them as a resource.
Yeah. I don't think I'm putting enough prey creatures in.
Yeah, everyone hears the dire wolves, but nobody hears the songbirds, right? Like,
right. Yeah, that's right.
And so players would need to back them into a corner or threaten their young or surprise them somehow to really kick off a combat. But the moment that retreat might seem like the best option, they take enough damage or there's an opening on the battlefield, they would absolutely move and dash without disengaging to the nearest safe place because speed is their best defense.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so when I'm thinking, so let's change it then. Let's go to domesticated animals. So when I'm thinking domesticated animals, okay, there used to be this show in the UK, I'll tell you this really quick, and it was called Dogs with Jobs. And strangely enough, it was on like mid-morning, right? Where if you hadn't gone to work yet, it's because you're not going to work, but you were watching Dogs with Jobs. And so that made me think, I like domesticated animals where they have jobs, whether it be that they, you know, they're like retriever dogs, or even maybe you could include medical dogs even in your campaigns, or you know, monkeys that will fetch the vials and the scrolls for the wizard. I like it when domesticated animals have jobs, so consider that if you're going to use domesticated animals.
That's a very Dragon Ball Z way of looking at things. Dan's not here to agree with me, but that's fine.
I've never watched Dragon Ball Z.
Anymore. It's fine. It's cool. It's
Canada, Megan, is Dragon Ball Z.
Stop it. I like the idea of, like, we have to remember that domesticated animals are also, like, in my mind, mounts, or like your horses, or the ones that we utilize within society, or like mules that will be on farms, or the cows that you're milking, like those kinds of things. Like, not only do you, to your point, Terry, have jobs within society, that's neat, but they also have a purpose in the ecosystem of how people survive. Right.
See, because that sounded patronizing.
We're back to normal and everything feels good.
And yours was drawn out. Like, it wasn't like a quick one. Like, you really, all the way through it, I was going, this bitch is fucking, I know what she's doing right.
This
Terry,
bitch.
Terry, you're doing fantastic.
You're doing great.
So, for domesticated animals, I just want to remind everybody that just because they're domesticated and they live in society in and around civilization does not mean that they are necessarily all domesticated like a dog is. Despite common D&D conventions where you've got a tamed bear or direwolf or even a cat that follows the party around, these should still pose a danger when there are erratic things or emergency things or even just strangers showing up. These are still animals that are not historically acclimated to people and having a relationship like you do with your pet dog, right? And a lot of times, especially in D&D, you can like call your frog over and he'll do a trick and like that's cool and I'm for it, but also not always. One of my favorite pets ever was the Grey Render. Not a beast, but the Grey Render that Megan had.
I was trying to remember what Gregory, what's his name, Gregory?
Jeremy. Jeremy Render.
I was gonna comment about it. We were talking about how we hated the name Gregory, but I couldn't remember if it was Gregory or what he was. But I remembered something anyways. Thank you for that. Now I remember.
Yeah, but I remember how he was absolutely domesticated for you. And he would fucking hunt Dan when Dan's back was turned. Like, he was violent. And I think he hated, what was it, trees? He would just eat trees?
Yes.
Like, he was an odd duck. But that's what I think about with domesticated animals. They should always be a little unpredictable. Otherwise, just make it a human.
Yeah, 100%. What's next?
Eight trees. Sorry, I was stuck on eight trees. Okay.
Eight trees like all broccoli. Right.
Okay. Well, let's move on to types of creatures that we know. So mammals first. So when I think of mammals, I also think of the fact that mammals will play to learn, right? They're young, will play to learn. So I'm thinking with my devious DM mind, I'm thinking I would take advantage of that because any party would absolutely be brought in by the playful baby bears that they're found. Or cats, get women in their 30s with their cats, Megan. So if you can get some baby kittens in there, don't do that like you don't know. Don't do that like you don't know.
Red.
But that's a devious way to bring the party in without just having them be ambushed. You know, they can maybe try and use some of those skills that they wouldn't normally use, like nature checks and survival checks or animal handling checks to get their way out of this situation when the mama bear comes.
Mm-hmm. I do like to remind folks that with the mammals, when I think of mammals, it is definitely thinking of like the family. So, you know, how you're talking about the kids, I always like to think that the parents are going to be protective of the children. So when it comes to nests and lairs or places where they live, and you see younglings of something, you might want to be afraid that like the mama bear is going to be the next thing that you're going to come across. So don't treat the baby bears with, you know, brutality of any kind. Don't stab first and like think about it. You have to take a moment and be like, why is this baby cub here? Kind of thing. Right. So that's exploration tip. Yeah.
and that's really fun too, because you could walk up and see a grizzly bear that wants to play and your character is going to be like, what the fuck? And it's just getting too rough because it's a fucking grizzly bear. But they don't realize that this is an infant dire grizzly bear. And then the one that comes, that's the size of a house, comes out of the bushes, right? Like, I really like that subversion. That's exactly like where I'm going with mammalian babies are the easiest ones that make players go, aw. And so Megan knows, I often like to set up traps out in the wilderness where it is a humanoid calling for help. And it makes the party, especially in the middle of the night, go out and find out what the hell's going on. And they're suspicious as hell. But you know what they're not suspicious about? Is when it's a distressed foal or a puppy or something that is caught in a snare and is whimpering for help out in the middle of nowhere. They think, hey, I found a new pet. What they don't realize is that this was a trap that the enemy is using with like major illusion. Or they have like literally put a puppy in danger to separate the party for a moment. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be far more effective against your seasoned players who know that someone calling for help is usually a doppelganger.
I hate that. And I hate you for that. Thank you.
I'm okay with it.
I know.
Wow. Okay. I've lost where we are. What are we moving on to? That says on to reptiles and snakes. I don't enjoy, but for D&D purposes as a DM, I would enjoy the idea of the snakes that have adjustable jaws, right? So they can swallow larger prey. I think that we often as DMs miss, we have activity in the wilderness when our players are out and they're traveling, but we kind of forget about what happens at night. And I like those nighttime threats, and there's still snakes out in the wild at nighttime. And I would just like to hint at, instill the idea into their mind that the idea of them being swallowed whole by a snake in the night is possible for where they are, and then just leave them with it.
Yeah, well, I love it. As you say, I like to remind people that reptiles and snakes have eggs. And in D&D and in other fantastic, whimsical worlds, you'd expect if you find an egg, something super interesting is going to get hatched. But no, it's just a gardener snake or a tiny little lizard that is not that special, but is now going to be your best friend.
so anticlimactic in a way. Just a regular lizard.
It's a regular old snake. Too bad.
When I think about reptiles and snakes, I often think about the other creatures out there that are like reptile themed, like a Nega or the Yuan-T or other shit like that. And all the ones where you have just shit tons of snakes around, but it's just enough, like your players put a single crossbow bolt into the snake and move on, or like it's a great big snake and it's two rounds of combat. So I like to lean on them more as the exploration pillar, and you are not going to creep out players as much as you will when you start describing snake skin that is just like hanging from tree branches that they walk into. Normally it's spider webs, but when you just have snake skin dry as paper rubbing across your flesh, that will make some players really come out of their skin.
Oh,
yeah.
Not for me.
Gross.
Aren't you guys both snaky?
Well, I mean, I've never had any complaints, but...
No, Terry, you're a Slytherin, right?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Megan, do you hate snakes? I know you hate spiders, but do you hate snakes?
No, I don't hate snakes. Not at all. No. Okay. My mom does. My mom has a deep fear of snakes, though, and it's been ingrained in our being forever that snakes do not belong in houses, so... But...
I'm not into it. I don't think I have a deep fear, but I'd rather not. That's the way I am. Like with it, I'd rather not. But if I'm not going to cry if you make me.
That's fair.
Yeah.
What's next?
Next, we have fish. So I don't know anything. I don't know a damn thing about fish. So I went on the internet looking for things about fish that I could use in me attempting to be better with fish. So I found out that many bony fish have a swim bladder, an internal gas-filled organ that helps control buoyancy. Allowing them to stay at different depths in the... It is fun, Megan, if you let me finish. Allowing them to stay at different depths in the water. So I thought that makes for an interesting item when harvested, because it could be used for this purpose by the party. And that's what I've got for my research on fish.
I love it. That should be the material component for the water breathing spell.
Well, it should be, yeah.
There you go.
Like you use it to cast a magic spell, and then you inflate the bladder like it's a balloon, and then you inhale the air out of it, and now you can breathe underwater for a certain amount of time.
That's gross. Mm-hmm. But I do love the way that you emphasize the material component there. Sorry, even the somatic component, I guess, if you're breathing it in, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say something along the lines of, I also don't know a lot about fish, and I think that's going to be the hard thing to deal with fish in your campaign, is I don't know what's going to be in the shallow waters fish. I don't know what's going to be in the deep ocean fish. I don't know what's a salt fish. I don't know what's a clean water fish. I know nothing about fish. So if you're playing in a water-based campaign, doing a little bit of fish research might be interesting enough so you know what types of fish to use where.
You know what? You made me think when you said that. The idea that everyone always says, what's his name, whenever you run into an NPC and you're never ready, what kind of fish is it? It's going to be the new one of that. Or anytime the DM and a fish swims up to you, what kind of fish is it? Right away. Or, you know, a snake slithers up, what kind of snake is it? Immediately.
I love it.
My response to that is always, roll a nature check and tell me how well you are good at identifying animals.
See, you'll be it. That's it.
So as far as you're concerned, because you rolled a 7, it's a big fish.
I love that. But then you're fucked when they roll like a 27 and you're like, let me do a quick Google.
No, I just go super underwhelming so that they don't ask again. It is a rainbow.
Just bore them to death.
Yeah.
Okay, who's next for fish?
All right. So me for fish. I do know a bit about fish. And I do know that fish, especially small fish and fish that are usually prey and not predators, move in either shoals or schools. Predators can as well, large fish can, but typically you see it in smaller fish. A school all moves the same direction. And so when you see a bunch of fish moving in the same direction, that might indicate that there's a predator behind them and they're moving away from it. Whereas a shoal is just what you see at the pet store. When you walk in, you just see just a whole bunch of tetras or neons or anything. They're all just hanging out kind of together and flitting in different directions. They're just random. So when a predator comes by, if they all sense it at once, it shouldn't be everybody swimming in the same direction. It should be fucking chaos to the point of blinding, churning water as they all panic to get away. And I think that would be a fantastic way to kick off a aquatic combat encounter.
I love it. And don't laugh at me, but I genuinely didn't know the difference between a school and a shoal of fish until I read your notes earlier when I was putting mine in. So
Most people don't. Most people just hear school of fish and think that's it. That's what you learn in like first grade and that's it. So
Yeah.
Okay. I guess we're moving on to other sea life. I don't have much for other sea life other than most people don't know this. We're from Vancouver, so we know this. Orcas are assholes and should probably be reoccurring villains in D&D.
So are sea lions. Sea lions are dicks.
Yeah. And dolphins? They're not coming up enough in D&D for me.
Yeah.
Dolphins are the psychopaths of the sea. Like, you do not want to swim with the dolphins.
Yeah, no. They're smart. I don't have anything extra for other sea life other than they're going to be bigger and they're probably going to be the predators of the smaller fish. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Other sea life is also available.
I like to think of things like crustaceans. There's actually a lot of really cool, weird shit out there. And if you are able to get your hands on a really interesting jellyfish mini of some sort, like, you could terrify your party with, like, terrestrial. Like, it's not other world, it's not aberrations, but you have tentacles. You've got octopi and squids. You have ink sacs and hard shells. There's a kind of aquatic snail that its shell is literally made of iron because it lives on the side of, like, a volcanic sea vent. It doesn't take much to look these things up to figure out where you can find some really bizarre inspiration and then apply that shit to land creatures too, because no one is expecting a wizard's guard dog to have an ink sac, right? Or to be able to just have suckers on the bottom of its feet to climb up the wall, right? So my big thing is that I know that most things in the ocean, they don't have anywhere to go. And a lot of the other stuff that's not a fish don't have a lot of really fast movement. So their defense a lot of times is to burrow. Just because the ocean floor looks barren doesn't mean it is. It just means that they're either laying in wait to ambush or they know there's a predator nearby. I would get very suspicious of an empty ocean floor.
Gross. I don't want to go to an ocean floor, period. I feel like the bottom of an ocean is not a place I want to go. So
yeah.
Yeah. Has anybody ever scuba dived?
No.
Yeah. Yeah, I did when I was in scouts. We did scuba diving, but we didn't like lake in Ontario, and it was underwhelming. It was just me mildly drowning over and over again in very shallow lake water because I had no idea where the top of the snorkel was when we went snorkeling, and that is as close as I ever came to being in the water, and I will never do it again.
Fair. Yeah, it's scary. Alrighty, what are we on? Birds? Birds. So as most people know, birds communicate using a variety of vocalizations. They have songs that have mimicry, some of them. Maybe they'll use songs as part of their mating display as well. But as I was researching birds, that got me thinking, I don't often use birds as an exploration tactic, as a sign or a clue. You know, they should be flying away en masse, right? If there's something, if there's a threat nearby, maybe you'll even hear some sort of territory song. And I don't think I use them often enough. So here's my reminder to you all, because I got to remind myself.
One, just to extrapolate a little bit more on that, we've talked about it a couple of times, I think, on the campaign builder, is birds are great for using as omens. A lot of cultures have done that. So if you want to talk about the exploration pillar with birds, use them as omens and portents. That could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, not even like omens, but like they're good for while you're hunting around. You'll know there's creatures or other things in the area if they're flying around or moving, or use the exploration part where all of a sudden all the birds go quiet. You do not hear the sounds of birds in the forest, right? They can be used as an environmental piece, I find.
As I understand, that means they're fucking the bees? Am I getting that right?
The bees.
Oh, okay.
No.
I like birds in my campaign, and yet I almost never use them. Like, Megan, when's the last time we ran into birds in D&D? It's been
never.
Forever, yeah. Like, Dan's familiar, Zoltan, was the last bird that was noteworthy. So that was a campaign ago.
Yeah.
But
for all the giant bears and giant badgers and giant sheep that we have for stat blocks, we don't have enough giant birds. We need to stop thinking about like the giant birds, like a giant hawk, a giant falcon, like the raptors. And we need to focus on a flight of 4-foot swallows that are like going around and through your party and just the damage that would do to you. Or the idea of looking at a 30-foot tall crane or heron. Or a territorial 8-foot duck. That's fantastical. That's fantasy. We should be dealing with that, especially in and around giants.
So an 8-foot duck sounds terrifying. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you've ever been asked the question about that. Would you fight 1 8-foot duck, or I think it's 100 1-foot ducks, but I always thought the 100 1-foot ducks.
Yeah, because I can dwindle that number down. We did this on a mailbag episode. It was a duck the size of a horse, or 100 horses the size of a duck.
Yes, that's correct. That's what it is. And, 100 and horses.
Yeah, because I know that after 10 seconds, there are not 100 horse-sized or duck-sized horses anymore. I've whittled it down to 93. I'm just stomping around in iron boots and taking care of shit, right?
Yeah, and they won't all fight. Some of them will run away.
They can't all get to you. 100, like, I don't... I'm a big guy, but I don't have the surface area for 100 ducks to peck at me at once.
The ones at the back don't even know what's going on.
No, they're not down with this fight.
I hate you.
What's anyway, insects. Insects. My only thing for insects, outside of the mechanics and stuff, is that I think we forget to use them for flavor. I think we could include them a lot more with our undead. Like, why doesn't your lich have insects coming out of its eye sockets and back into its mouth and down and around? They're great for flavor. They're disgusting. Nobody likes them, but we don't use them for flavor often enough.
Yeah.
Like literal flavor when you eat them?
Have you ever eaten an insect? I've eaten a cricket. Eaten like two, no. Three.
Yeah, we had multicultural day at school when I was in grade 7, I want to say. And they brought in, everybody was encouraged to bring in like a national dish. So that's when I had haggis for the first time. Sun-dried iguana flesh. But I also had chocolate-covered ants. And I only remember being grossed out in theory at first. And then it was just chocolate with a crunch. Like, there's no flavor to them.
Yeah.
Most insects are hollow, empty husks.
Yeah.
You're mostly eating chocolate. How was the haggis, though? It's good, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really fucking good.
Yeah. People don't know. Yeah. Shout out to haggis. Okay. Megan, insects? Did you do insects yet? I'm losing track.
I don't want to talk about insects. Another thing to remember about insects is that, like, when they're singular, they're not as annoying. But when you have a swarm of them coming at you or in your campsite or just causing a ruckus, that is when they become extremely annoying. And so that's a good thing that you can kind of play with as a DM for sure.
I think that we need to lean into the fact that some insects are bioluminescent. If your fireflies and lightning bugs aren't spelling out omens for the orc in the party or the diviner, then I think you're missing out on an opportunity. And making random worms or beetles glow is all it takes to make your fantasy world feel more bizarre and magical. Just mixing and matching some of the traits of other creatures will just make this entirely mundane beast, this beetle, that if you pull its hind leg, it glows for the next 3 or 4 minutes, right? Like, that's really interesting and really cool, and we don't think about that shit as much in 5th edition.
Right.
So this is where I think you mentioned swarms, Megan. I want to shift a little bit into the kind of different beasts out there. And I managed to narrow it down into 5 basic categories beside just beast. I went through a fucking lot of books to go through this to figure out how we can lump these beasts together. And because, I mean, there's just like wolf or moose or quipper or whatever. Like, there's just a lot of them, but there are some unique properties that we can focus on that stand aside and make it kind of a fantasy feel, or they have a mechanic to them. So the first one I want to mention is swarms. This is the obvious one. And the rules about a swarm is that swarms can gain hit points or they cannot gain hit points or temporary hit points. They can move through any space that is big enough for a single one of their creatures to squeeze through. They can exist in a player's space. So that's it. That's what all swarms have in common. They can be a real fucking problem because most of the time they are resistant to most kinds of mundane damage. So you've got to get creative with your damage types when you're fighting swarms. And I know that it's a classic thing from previous editions to use a torch because fire will work on swarms of insects. But that's not necessarily true in 5th edition. Not on all insects. So
yeah. Did we want to keep the same initiative? We want to roll again.
No, let's roll again.
All right.
Roll again. 18. 4. 9.
All right. Reverse order then. Yeah, we need to do it. So the first thing that I think about when I think about swarms is that they can exist in a player's space. But don't forget that they also want to exist in a player's hair or clothes or bags or orifices. They want to climb in ears and up noses. Just because the swarm dies doesn't mean the players won't be dealing with nuisance bugs for a few hours after that. One of the things that I've always wanted to do is use con saves to figure out whether or not your players can get the benefits of the next rest, whether it's short or long, depending on how aggressive the individual bugs or creatures are. For example, if you are covered in a swarm of mosquitoes, there are still some around. When you reach into your backpack, if you've taken bites, you may not be able to get rest, right? You're just going to be itchy. You're going to feel them crawling down the back of your neck because they were caught in your hair when you killed the rest of the swarm. It shouldn't just be, hey, we managed to kill exactly 100% of every insect in this swarm. That seems ridiculous. So you should deal with individual bugs at a pest level after that.
Yeah. I also want to add, like, for the idea of, like, their nests and their layers is you don't know they're there until it's too late. Like, when you're traversing through, like, long grass or walking through a forest or just hanging through trees, you're going to walk into a swarm of these by mistake, and then it's going to be extremely annoying and extremely frustrating. Or as a DM, you can utilize them in battle areas, like when you're in combat, so that you can maneuver people around the arena because you're going to want to move to get out of these swarms, or you're going to want to deal with the swarm before you deal with the next thing. It can kind of add a little bit more battle control if your team is a little bit of out of control, right?
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So for swarms, I actually don't stick to the hit points too much. I prefer to just use them as one-hit minions, and I just love to fill the room with them. Because knowing that they can share space with the player characters means that they're kind of always swarmed, because realistically that's what it would be like. And then it also restricts the vision, because technically there's a creature type in front of them. But I just drop their hit points right down to one. I just tell them, I say, just give me something good. And if they get a 10 or more, that's it for me. Otherwise, I'll say I'll take one more. But I think something we miss with swarms is it later on, once you get out of that swarm, these can also come with constitution saves for diseases as well. Depending on the type of swarm, you don't know what these things have got. And I love a good disease in D&D, and this is a perfect time to use them.
I really like that. I mean, we don't... There are rules for it in Tomb of Annihilation, but that's the only place you see it. I just keep thinking about the most interesting swarm that I ever found. I was a player. This was back in 4th edition. And the DM made us roll survival checks consistently out in the desert. We were traversing through it. What he didn't tell us is that if we rolled a 1 on our survival check, then we would accidentally bed down for the night on top of like an anthill. Or I forget what the creature was. It was a bug from D&D. But in the middle of the night, we were covered in these things, right? Unable to get a long night's rest, and we're taking damage, right? Mm-hmm. Exhaustion's kicking in, the whole nine yards. So it's, and then I remember one of them got, one of the players got a disease from it, which is fucking wild. So,
yeah.
The next category is giant creatures. There are a lot of them. There's also a handful of like dire creatures as well, but not as many as you'd think. And the difference between them, I'll cover giant first. A giant version of a creature has a handful of things that are consistently true. They have natural armor 9 times out of 10 because their hide is thicker. They've got more hit points. They are clearly bigger. They go up a size category, sometimes 2. And they have increased strength and constitution. Their attacks, whatever they are, will reflect that increase in strength. When you come to dire, they tend to have a little bit more intelligence, a little bit more wisdom as well, and they should have more advanced hunting tactics and actions. Sometimes they will get a beef up to almost like sentient level, but dire is not just bigger, it's also like the dire wolves in Game of Thrones are not just big wolves. They have personalities and they are almost like people, right? Mm-hmm. So when I think of a giant creature and I want to paint that picture as a DM, I lean into my descriptive words. Giant weasels don't scurry, they stampede. Giant bears don't walk, they stomp. Giant birds don't swoop, they dive bomb. Everything with any sort of giant or dire beast needs to be a bombastic verb that the players will feel that descriptive language a lot deeper than just the ground shakes and this thing steps out of the forest. That's not enough, right? It needs to come thundering out of the forest.
Yeah, I think as a DM, focusing on those descriptor words is going to be the best thing that you can do. Because especially if you just have like a wolf walks through the forest and is coming closer to you, and it's larger than usual, is not that exciting. You just might think that it's like the alpha, or it's just like a part of like a different kind of like grouping. But like, if you talk about like the size of its paws or like how like large its like coat of fur is, and it seems to look at you knowingly, like knows who you are and what you are, right? That those are the descriptors that are going to make the giant version of a regular creature a little bit more exciting for players.
Also, their breaths are deeper and more violent, right? Yeah. They snort and grunt.
I think all of that is true, but I think what is also true is that their behaviors won't change. Their behavior will still be the same as the lower size category. So a giant cricket is still going to be chirping at night, right? And a giant bear will just start eating you. It doesn't care if you're dead or not. And a giant cobra will still hiss at you. So if you're, as DMs, if you're struggling on how to roleplay these creatures, just remember that their behavior is exactly the same. The scary part is they're massive. So it should be easy for you.
Speaking of massive, let's talk for a second about, what do y'all think you're going to say next? Dinosaurs and prehistoric creatures. Thank God Megan's muted right now. So you're still muted. Stop cursing at me. So the thing about dinosaurs and prehistoric creatures is that these are really no different than regular beasts. And the context that makes them special, interestingly enough, is not in Dungeons & Dragons. It's in our own real-world understanding of them. Because they are fantastical, because they've gone extinct. We've only ever seen their bones and the movies that people guess about them. We're learning new shit about them all the time because we just don't know. These are fantastical creatures that inspire awe in your players. But how do you communicate that? How do you say, hey, and everybody here is awe-inspired when the Triceratops trundles out of the forest? You can't tell players how they feel until they get a frightened condition. So what you can do, though, is have an NPC react strongly to the presence of a rare dinosaur. And that should help the players feel more wonder. I think about the very beginning of Jurassic Park. Before we saw the dinosaurs for the first time, we were holding our fucking breath because the characters were seeing them for the first time and their jaws were just slack. They were open. They were blown away. And that made the audience feel blown away as well. So when it comes to dinosaurs, that is how we can communicate how special and unique they are. And other prehistoric creatures, mammoths and saber-toothed tigers and shit as well.
Yeah, same, even to like the mammal side of prehistoric creatures, like they're going to stalk prey slightly different, right? They're going to look a little bit different than your regular wolf or predatorial creature that you're used to coming across, right? Like describe the large size of the teeth or how the nails don't retract because they're too large for their paws, like those kinds of things, right? So when we were talking about earlier about predatorial creatures, most of the dinosaurs and prehistoric creatures are. So that's going to be something that you're going to play into for sure.
Most of the stat blocks are for sure. Although we do get a lot of the not predatory ones, the herbivores, are so fucking huge. They pose their own unique problems, like a stegosaur or a brontosaurus or whatnot, right? Like,
yeah.
So they're just always dangerous, no matter what.
Yeah, I think one thing I want to focus on would be that they would come with their own, they would come with very strange calls that are unfamiliar to the party. So I always like to think about what's going on at night. And I mentioned it earlier on, but this is another example where there would be very unique calls coming out of the wild. And what does that mean? There's a challenge in it there that it's not totally clear. We know with the regular types of beasts, most likely what is out there, what that call means, but you wouldn't with these creatures. And I think it's an interesting thing to include.
Speaking of interesting things to include, let's jump into the chimeric creatures. And this is something that I don't think most of our listeners are going to be super familiar with, unless they own Icewind Dale Rime of the Frost Maiden. There are a bunch of chimeric creatures that exist. These are naturally occurring beasts. They're still beasts, but they have been touched by magic in some way. And so they've got different effects, like magical things that have been imbued upon them. We have six in the book, and I'm just going to list them off because they're really, really straightforward. The first one is the chimeric baboon, which is a baboon stat block, except their attacks do additional poison damage. A chimeric cat is just a cat stat block, but it has blind sight and tremor sense for some reason. Chimeric foxes can change the color of their fur, which gives them advantage on stealth checks. Chimeric hares can fly up to 30 feet per round. Chimeric rats can breathe air and water. And chimeric weasels have eyes like little spotlights that give 20 feet of bright light and 20 feet of dim light beyond that. When I think about adding these small little details to a chimeric creature, I want to point out that not any one of them goes up in CR compared to their original one. So these are all kind of passive or exploratory details to add on. And I like to think about that for my own beasts. I said earlier, you know, have worms or beetles that glow, right? We should be thinking about exploration, like things that can teleport, right? An animal you wouldn't expect to, that can, like a snake that can teleport. Now we have a chimeric snake. This is what I want to think about a lot of the time, and it doesn't make it a monstrosity. And the reason that's important is because there are some spells that specifically indicate this works on beasts and humanoids, right? So it should still work on these creatures.
Yeah, I think it's also a great introduction to characters if you've been inherently in areas where magic doesn't exist. These are really good things to kind of like plot in for the exploration pillar, that you're getting closer to somewhere where magic is inherently existing.
Oh, like the Feywild. The Feywild. That these would be great in the Feywild.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I look at these and I think about how it might change their behavior. Are chimeric baboons going to be extra aggressive because they know that they cause more damage? What else did we see there? Chimeric hares can fly 30 feet per round. Does that mean that they're as jumpy as that, no pun intended, as they usually would be, or as afraid as they usually would be if they know there's more chance of them escaping? The weasels with the 20 feet of dim light coming out of his eyes doesn't sound like it's going to last very long in the wild to me. So what does that do for its behavior?
Yeah, it's interesting. They're interesting creatures, and you've got to think that these are probably unique and they've been affected by the world around them. You're not going to have a whole burrow full of, or multiple burrows full of these chimeric hares that can fly, right? Mm-hmm. There'd be
right.
8 or 9 maybe as it propagates its little species, but it's not going to spread across the land. This isn't going to be something famous. It'll be like, go here, find the weasel with glowing eyes, right?
Right.
Speaking of weird, random shit, let's talk about all of the fucking space creatures we have, and let's not spend too long on it because I'm already annoyed. Spelljammer gives us all sorts of different kinds of space whales, space fish, space bugs, space jellyfish. There's all sorts of like sea creatures and insects. We also famously have the giant space hamster, which I believe is Megan's favorite beast of all time.
No, absolutely not.
No. I remember you just like losing your shit on the giant episode where I said, hey, you should cover this. And you went nuts. So
I just think it's hilarious.
I have to say, there's a lot of shit out there that is just space for the sake of space. Like, Terry, I don't know if the episodes have come out yet. You and I recorded the lunar dragon, and the solar dragon. The solar dragon didn't have limbs. It only had wings, right? Everything's just a little bit weirder, and it's adapted to live out in the ravages of vacuumous space with these long distances in between. And you don't have to sit down and come up with the eating habits, or it has 6 stomachs so that they can feast for short periods of time, but it'll last a long time out in the cold. We don't have to worry about natural armor or resistance to cold or all that shit, because space, no, it's just fantasy. It's bullshit. It is fantasy space bullshit. I don't see why we can't have space birds and space reptiles just like hanging out on meteorites and just being the space version of. Add a couple limbs, throw on some antenna and a couple more eyes, boom, space version. Just remember that even though they don't breathe, they still have motivations. They'll still be territorial, they'll still get hungry, they still have all those other things. They're not just hanging out waiting for the next spaceship to come by.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of Spelljammer. Folks who have listened to Beyond's podcast for quite some time know I'm not a big fan of Spelljammer, but to your point, they're animals, they're predators, they're creatures. They're going to have all the same characteristics and animal instincts that our quote-unquote fantasy animals do. And if you're going to bring in one of the space creatures or beasties, in my mind, it has to be for a very specific reason. Or, you know, like they came down and they had nowhere to go, so they made a small little hut somewhere and they exist. And it could be a really cool, like, introduction to Spelljammer without actually having to explore it, right? So but I personally would not use it.
Honestly, I'm not interested. The vacuum, the loneliness of space is more interesting than space fish. And space goldfish is a fucking thing in D&D.
Yeah, I think I've been trying to tell myself I'm excited about Spelljammer for a long time, that I want to do it and I'm interested in it, but then I'm just never quite there, and I keep thinking I'm not interested. And it was when I got to this section of this episode in the notes, Adam, that I went, I don't give a shit anymore about space and Spelljammer. The only thing I can think is you have an extra challenge here in that the environment most of the time is going to be very boring. It's in space. It's what can you do? And it's the environment that the creatures typically work within. So I'm thinking, okay, well, I don't just want to do giant versions of everything. Maybe I'll just do something very small. So maybe it's the space creatures that are very small that are coming at you that would be the terrifying. You can use the swarms, space swarms, in an interesting way. Get your diseases back out the ends. So I think that's the direction I'd go to make it a bit more interesting.
I actually like that a lot. Like, swarms in space are far more interesting to me than this is a giant space monkey that is the size of a planetoid and floats doing space monkey shit. I don't care. So let's talk about something I do care about, though, and that is awakened beasts, because these can be really fun NPCs. But an awakened animal will still have a lot of its memories and personality, and that's something that people forget. When a dog has the awakened spell cast upon it, most DMs will have them go, oh my God, I can finally think. And can you understand what I'm saying? And they're shocked. They're appalled. They automatically, no matter what they were before, they get the personality of a curious toddler. Just, what does this do? I can manipulate things with my thumbs. And that's not at all what an awakened animal is. An awakened animal is just the opportunity to provide the ability to understand and predict consequences, to use logic, and to communicate. We're just raising the intellect. So again, predict consequences, use logic, and communicate. It doesn't make them suddenly standoffish scholars that know better than the NPCs or the player characters, or helpful guides because, hey, we awakened the rat. The rat doesn't give a fuck what you're doing in the dungeon. It's still hungry. It just knows how to talk about it now, right? So until they've gained the experience when dealing with other intelligent creatures and figuring out the ins and outs of culture and whatnot, they're ignorant of things, even though they have the basic understanding to be able to communicate and work through more complex scenarios.
Yeah, it's the inquisitive nature, right? So it's the fact that they can now ask questions if they have questions, or if they don't have questions, they don't care, but they're going to probably listen to you asking them questions and then be able to give you an insight to how they operate, but they don't care or know anything about you. So that's got to be an interesting role-playing thing for DMs to have to navigate, especially when you have those players that just want to make friends with every animal they come across. Like, this is probably going to happen to every DM at some point in time in their life. So just kind of keeping that in mind that, no, they're not dumb. They just have no interest, right?
You know, I think about how this could be a reflection of the dynamic, even the morality, the alignment of the party based on how they shape this creature's personality now that it's been awakened. You're right, it's not just going to be like a toddler, but it will be ignorant and it may be curious about things, and its personality is going to be developed based on the people that it spends its time with, and that is the party. So it's a reflection of them if this thing becomes a murder hobo or whatever it does. But I think I would use it as a tool to reflect where the party sit on the moral alignment.
Yeah, have that weird moral conversation. Yeah. Love it.
Like, you're responsible for the development of this personality.
Yeah.
It's like the toddler that looks up at you and says, why can't I say fuck? You do it.
Fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, well, now let's get into a little bit of the last part and a little bit of the meat and potatoes of this episode. We're going to go through a couple of very specific beasts and creatures. So we all have our own little list. I'm thinking we'll all roll initiative, see who kind of goes first. And then we'll just talk about inspirations from there.
Sure.
All right.
All right, let's do it.
I rolled a 19.
11.
I 2.
Blessings. All right, so the first creature I'm going to talk about is the Almirage. Thank you. So the easiest way to describe these ones is that they are bunnies with a unicorn horn. They're considered small beast creatures, which I think are absolutely adorable, because in my head, I'm like, a giant bunny with a unicorn horn sounds absolutely frightening. So the fact that they're still small is quite adorable, and I love it. They are one of those types that does have a quick speed of 50. So that's the part that I love about them, is they can hop around and move around with quick speeds. Otherwise, they're not that interesting. They have keen senses for being a beast, but then they attack with their horn, and that's kind of all you got really going on for them. There is a little bit of history of like how they came to be. But yeah, it basically just runs around and tries to spear people with its horn. That's what it does.
I've met a lot of guys like that, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this one can actually, it actually is written into its stat block that if a DM, with DM's permission, obviously, that you can do the Find Familiar spell and summon one.
Yeah, it can be a familiar, which is kind of neat, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, I mean, they're cute, but like, I, you know, again, they're just bunnies with a horn. Sure. So
a lot of these ones that we're going to cover through this, I mean, we got 12 really simple ones to go through. Beasts are not complicated creatures.
No.
It can be if you want to get into their whole, like, their whole subculture and get into how they interact. I mean, you could go live out in the wilderness with any one of these and learn things about them. But as much as you and the druid might want to, the other players don't give a shit. They're gonna either kill it or pet it and walk the fuck away. So let's hit these rapid fire. The flying snake is the next one that I have. That's from the Monster Manual. It gets literally two sentences as a description for it. This is a tiny CR18 snake with wings. It's brightly colored. You can find it in remote jungles. And there are people like tribes people or cultists out in the middle of the wilderness that'll actually domesticate them and use them as messengers to deliver scrolls that they like wrap their little bodies around and then go fly around. They've got a walk speed of 30, a fly speed of 60, and a swim speed of 30, which I guess makes sense because they're mostly snakes.
Yep.
What makes them interesting is that they've got blind sight out to 10 feet. They do have flyby, which is important because one hit will kill them, but they do one piercing damage and 3d4 poison with their tiny bites. It's CR18, but if you put 8 of these against a level 1 party, you will fucking drop them. Yep. That is too much poison. So these guys, especially with flyby, like you have to hold your action to hit them even and then hope that you can, right? So
mm-hmm.
they're going to be opportunistic hit and run attackers, and they assume that they probably hide in like long grass or treetop canopies where they make their nests up and away from others, right? Where sturdy branches meet and shit like that. So there's not a whole lot going for these guys, except they are low key going to murder your party with the action economy.
Yeah.
If there's a bunch of them in one place. Yeah.
I love them as messengers though. What a fantastic very cool idea.
It's a cute imagery. Yeah.
You're
especially
snake.
If you send in one back and forth, your party would look forward to it. They would say, is this the day the snake is due to arrive? And I'll say, no,
two not more today. Sleeps. Oh, Lord.
I have the flying monkey. It's small beast. It's exactly what you think it is. It's a little flying monkey. It's got 3 hit points, a low armor class. But you do have 3 speeds. You have a walking speed, a climbing speed, and a flying speed. Not much in the way of strength or intelligence or charisma. Dexterity is its highest stat. But it's also familiar as well. So the Find Familiar spell, you can also summon a flying monkey. And they have pack tactics, so that means they get advantage on attack rolls against creatures if they have an ally within 5 feet. So for me, I'm thinking when I see those speeds, if they are forced to go into combat, they're probably going to do it from above.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have flyby, but they're probably still going to try and get out of the way. They're probably going to use that pack tactics and try and take you out within round one. So level one party, if they get the initiative, they could do quite well against them.
Yeah, this is definitely like the group of them is going to be super annoying. It's like dealing with a giant swarm of annoying things. So
I know. I love Maybe it. Just one flying monkey. What a good familiar.
Yeah, it'd be a good familiar, good communicator, you know?
I'm not as into familiars. Sorry, go on. I'm sidetracking. You go on. No. You run your episode, Megan.
We're doing our thing here, dude. Let's get through this.
Just talk about animals. Just talk about animals.
Just about pets. My next one is the dire wolf, which is obviously in the regular monster manual. They are considered large beasts but are only a CR of 1. They of course have a larger speed of 50. So as Adam was saying earlier, when it comes to the giant versions of creatures, their speed, their XYZ tends to increase. So same thing with this one. They have keen hearing and keen smell, along with, of course, pack tactics. That makes sense for the type of animal that they are. If you want to fight one, all they really do is bite. So they're not that scary. So the CR of 1 kind of checks out for me. including the fact that they only have a natural AC of 14. So if you get close to one and go to fight one, like a singular, it's going to be pretty easy. But again, if you have a pack of them coming after you, they're going to be a little bit harder to take down because they're going to get that bonus and advantage from having those pack tactics. And you're not going to be able to sneak up on them because of their keen sense of smell and all that kind of stuff. So as a group, very difficult to deal with. A singular one, if it finds you, probably a little bit easier to deal with. But other than that, it's nothing overly fancy. But I feel like I would let someone keep this as a pet, even though it is not a fine familiar creature.
Yeah. I love it. Okay, I've got an axe beak. An axe beak, it's a large beast. It's a shaped beak. It's like a murder chocobo is what it is. It's got an axe-shaped murder beak, and it's blue. So in the way of, well, I'll give you the stats first, okay? So they're higher in their strength, dexterity, constitution, not too bad. They're not very intelligent. They're two, so that's like intelligence, a dog, five charisma, and then just whatever for wisdom. But their attacks, they only have a beak attack. They don't have anything else special to them. So I don't think I would want to include these in my campaign as a creature that you would get into combat with. I absolutely want these to be mounts. I don't want them to be mounts all the time. Like, I don't want the murder chocobos for the party all the time, but just for a chapter. Just let them use them to get across the grasslands or something.
Yeah, I love that they're just evil chocobos in our visually in our mind and how they operate.
Yeah, it says unaligned for their alignment, but I mean, I'm probably going to have them slightly on the more, like, technically geese are not evil, right? But, you know.
No, they are very much chaotic evil.
Yeah. What do you got, Adam?
My next one is the cranium rat. Now, this is a tiny CR0 rat with a clear dome over the top of its head, revealing its glowing skull. So, its glowing brain inside. So this replaces the skull. They've got telepathy. They're immune to all divination spells and anything that would read their thoughts or emotions. They are beasts in Volos, and they have been traditionally in previous editions. According to Monsters of the Multiverse, now they're aberrations because they're very closely tied to Mind Flayers, who like to use them as spies. What they do is they find regular rats, they bombard them with psionic energy, and then they make them do their bidding and go in to spy on civilizations so they know where they can like take over. Their bite does 1 piercing damage. These are not meant to be in combat.
No.
Despite 30 feet of dark vision, they have a bonus action where they can shed 5 feet of dim light from their brains, which I assume is so that they can see color.
That makes sense.
They have the ability to communicate with telepathy, like I said, but they aren't smart enough to have a language of their own. Their telepathy is probably through images and sensations. And their dark vision means they're probably stealthy as fuck, and they like to hang out wherever regular rats are found. So they probably only turn on their glowing brain when they absolutely need the light. Mm-hmm. I would definitely have it glow dimly whenever they use their telepathy, just, you know, like for flavor. Just like as it's thinking, you can see little arcs of electricity or something in its gray matter. Also, I want to point out that they come in CR5 swarms, which actually gives them spellcasting, including command, comprehend languages, detect thoughts, confusion, and dominate monster. 1 is a nuisance, 25 is a fucking issue.
Yeah, right? That seems to be the common theme right now with all these beasts.
I like cranium rats. I like using them. I think they're weird. I wish they'd be familiars as well, but they are so closely tied to mind flayers that it's hard to have a conversation.
Hard to separate it.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that's fair. My next one is the wolfware. This one is in the Minsk and Booze Journal of Villainy, not to be mistaken with werewolves, but they are similar. They don't exist due to the disease or the curse of the lycanthrope. They are actually just naturally occurring within the world. How does this happen, you may ask? It is when a werewolf and, you know, a regular wolf or, you know, what have babies and children.
Now, is this
no. You're not like allowed to do that. And you know why. And you know why.
I know why.
Because you're a man or a woman, which I don't know. I don't want to know. I don't want to think. You know why.
It's okay. At the end of the day, they do have the same issues like other werewolves do, such as they are susceptible to wolf's bane, but instead of being vulnerable to silver, they are vulnerable to iron, so that does make them a little bit different in that way. They do have different abilities that pop off, whether they're in their normal form versus their shapeshifter form, because obviously they shapeshift between their regular humanoid form and then their lycanthrope form. So they, as like their regular form, they have multi attacks with like long swords and that kind of stuff. But then when they're in their wolf form, they have their bite and their claws. The neat thing about them though, is they have something called the lethargic song, which can only be done when they're in their humanoid form, where they play a magical melody on an instrument. And then any humanoid within 200 feet of the wolf were that can hear the melody must succeed on DC 13 whiz save or be slowed for 10 minutes. So it just slows everyone down, which I think is really cool. But that is pretty much the only neat thing about them. Otherwise, it's just kind of a worse version of a werewolf. Yeah.
All right. Well, I hated them.
Too bad. But...
No, I like you, them Megan. Because... I don't hate you. I just didn't like the creature. Did you like it? I thought it felt weird.
I think it is weird. I think it's a good way to throw them for a loop when they've already seen the werewolves and the loop gurus and they've dealt with lycanthropy and all that shit. And
yeah.
Then you hit them with one of these things, it's going to make them all go, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. Yeah.
What's next?
I got a Moorbounder. A Moorbounder is essentially just a giant muscular cat that has tusks that comes out the side of it, the side of his face. But it's got some interesting parts to its stat block here. So hit points are 30, but it has a speed of 70 feet, a walking speed of 70 feet. It's strong, it's dexterous, there is higher stats. Intelligence is low at 2, charisma is low at 5. But its standing leap allows it to jump up to 40 feet in a long jump and 20 feet for a high jump. And then if you couple that with its 70 feet of walking speed, it can cover a lot of distance in a single round. It also means it can move around the battlefield easily without incurring opportunity attacks. So it's likely that you're only going to run into probably one or two of them. I don't think they're pack animals. They're not. They look like they're solitary or maybe with a mate. But yeah. Their movement around the battlefield is going to be their biggest advantage.
That's cool.
Yeah, they feel like super duper mountain lions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's Momo. What do you got, Adam?
I've got something that I want to point out. They do this a lot in 5th edition. Anybody that's opened up a module has seen this. Where, so the monster is called a whirlworm. And it's from the latest Planescape book. I wanted to point it out because recently we were just doing a bunch of river shit and you guys fought a sea serpent.
Yeah.
Also, I know that Dan in his other campaign is currently doing a whole bunch of piratey shit and people do a lot of water stuff. We do get pirate questions about once, every 3 months or so, someone will come in and like, I'm doing an aquatic campaign. And I want to point out the whirlworm specifically. The thing that they do in the book, and they do this everywhere, especially for beasts and humanoids, is they say, just use this stat block. So this is supposed to be a huge eel-type creature that acts very much like a sea serpent, but you're just supposed to use the giant crocodile stat block for it. It is such a strange comparison, but it makes me think, especially for these fantastical beasts, what does that imply? So let me go through it. Keep in mind, this was for a giant crocodile, and it's now for a sea serpent.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a huge CR5 creature that can't breathe underwater. It can only hold its breath for 30 minutes, which is absolutely insane for an aquatic creature. Also, a young sea serpent from Fizban's Treasury of Dragons is a CR8. So this is actually a viable, like, big threat at the end of tier 1 if you're out and about on the water. The swim speed is 50 feet per round. Multi-attack hits with a bite that does 3d10 plus 5 piercing and grapples and restrains. But then it hits someone that's not grappling with its tail, doing 2d8 plus 5 bludgeoning damage and forcing a strength save against it being prone. All of that feels really crocodile, and yet it makes perfect sense for, like, a sea serpent as well.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great creature for coastal and river adventures that threaten low-level parties. They'll hit hard, but they can be killed easily enough. The real threat, as always, here is the water. But what makes them interesting is that they act almost like snakes, that like just aquatic snakes that still need to breathe. We don't have anything like that really in 5th edition. We just put our big snakes in water. So I assume that these things live in reeds or shallow caves because they don't regularly submerge to eat outside of hunting. But even then, you won't find them in deep water because the most they can do is go 15 minutes down before they got to come 15 minutes back up, right? So when we think about this, they don't have dark vision, which is something that would hinder you underwater. This is a shallow water threat, and we don't really have anything else like that. And a lot of this is implied, even though we're just grabbing a stat block from somewhere else and giving it a different shape and a different personality, right? Mm-hmm. So the one thing that it says in the Planescape book is that they will flee when they get reduced to 10 or fewer hit points. But at level 5, I honestly see my creature get dropped from like 18 hit points to 0 in one hit. Like it's rare that's going to come up. But I like the Whirlworm. It's interesting. It made me think outside the box in a way that I wasn't expecting to.
Yeah, they're survivalists, right? Terry, I believe, were you next?
I can't remember. Yes, I think. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So my final one today is that of a hulking crab. It's exactly what you think it is. It's probably bigger than you think it is, though. This is a huge beast, unaligned. Great armor, 17 with natural armor. Pretty decent hit points with 76. It's a CR5, but it has two speeds, as walking speed and a swim speed of 30 feet. Obviously, its strength and its constitution are going to be its two highest stats. Mm-hmm. And then charisma, intelligence, all that's going to be low. It's amphibious, so it can breathe air and water, but it has something called shell camouflage. So that means while the crab remains motionless with its eye stalks and pincers tucked close to its body, it resembles a natural formation of detritus. It'll be a DC 15 nature check to discern what it is in reality. And so if you want a good ambush tactic, that would be what to do. I would probably use this as a gate guard to maybe a dragon turtle or a larger aquatic creature's lair, where the challenge is going to be just trying to get away from it, because it has a multi-attack where two claw attacks and then you're grappled if it hits you with them. So you can get one or two of those players right away. They know that they're not going to try and kill this thing. They're just trying to get into the entrance of the lair, but it would just, I just constantly have them, especially if they had limited time with their water breathing or holding their breath abilities, I would just be constantly trying to grapple them to hold them in place just to frustrate them and use their resources.
Stupid grapple. Both yours lost me at grapple. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Yay, grapple.
Yay. I missed my last one, so I'll talk about my last one, which is the Titanother. I hope I said that one right. But these can be found in the Big B's Glory of Giants, which are basically a huge beast that resembles that of a rhinoceros, except it sometimes has horns, sometimes doesn't. It just depends on its environment. They have a trampling running speed of 50. And by trampling, what I actually mean is they just have the ability to stomp as an attack if you're going to attack and fight it. Along with a natural armor of 16, obviously kind of, again, we talked about how when you're looking at the larger giant version of creatures, they're going to have a thicker skin, a little bit of a thicker hide, something a little bit harder to hit. And this brings them up to a CR of 5. And I think it's just because of the harder to hit, super fast moving, and a very large creature that can stomp you.
Well, anything huge like that is going to be a problem. All three of these that we're wrapping up with are huge creatures, although I guess the whirlworm was as well. So
yeah,
there's something to be said for huge sized beasts. Like, that makes them scary. We talked about it a little bit when I mentioned dinosaurs, right? Like, there should be a scariness. Have you guys ever stood beside an elephant in real life?
No, not
in real life.
I did. I managed to do that over at the Pacific National Exhibition that we have. They had elephants, and the kids could come down and ride the elephants, and I did not fucking want to do that. I was one of those kids that was just freaking out. This was too big for me. So
yeah.
I love huge creatures. They're, now that I'm an adult and can keep my distance from them. My last one is it's called the Relic Sloth. This is from Strixhaven, and it has a very specific use. These things are, like I say, they're huge size. They're CR2, but they're domesticated. They're massive white sloths that are used as beasts of burden. One of the schools at Strixhaven is all about like archaeology and digging shit up and going into dangerous places. And relic sloths are perfect for that because they've got these massive claws on their hands that are used for climbing. They move frustratingly slowly at only 20 feet per round, and that just means that they're taking their time to step in the appropriate places, whereas a mule or other pack animal might, you know, slip and break an ankle.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a climb speed of 20 feet. Their claws can do damage, and they do auto grapple on a hit. And they have these massive, really cool giant tusks that are apparently not for combat because it's not mentioned in the stat block. As a reaction, they can negate an effect that would move them out of their spaces or an effect that would knock them prone. And it's called slow but sturdy. So once around, they can use the reaction to just be like, no, I'm not moving. I will just fucking stand here. Honestly, there isn't much I'd do with these. I'd probably just use them as unique mounts through mountainous regions or as like a majestic creature that you would find deep in the wilderness somewhere. You'd come across four or five of these things slowly walking through the foliage, right?
Yeah, giant background creatures. Yeah.
Yeah. Just something to feel a little bit more fantastical.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of, that accurately sums up, not all, but the majority of the beasts, like direwolves and axe beaks and cranium rats are unique enough, but everything from a Almiraj and flying snake through to like a Moorbounder and a Titanotheer, whichever one, it's for the fantastical feel of it, right? Because they're different than what you're expecting.
Yeah, 100%. All right, well, that's it for all of our beasties we're going to talk about today. But before we finish off this episode, let's have a short info break.
If you've been inspired by the conversation in this episode, please feel free to reach out and share your creativity and ideas with us and the rest of the community. You can reach us on Facebook and Instagram or on our subreddit r/itsamimic. Also, if you're feeling particularly generous, please follow and subscribe and leave us positive reviews, likes, and comments. Engagements like that help us pop up on search engines and keep this show running.
So before we wrap this episode up, I got to point out that the beasts category only goes up to mammoth and wolfware alpha at level 6, deep spider and giant ape at level 7, and tyrannosaurus rex and sperm whale at level 8. Do you think it makes sense for game design?
Meg is laughing at sperm.
You had me at sperm. I started laughing. I'm sorry.
I was watching for it. I was reading along and I was like, I'm going to watch Megan's reaction when he says sperm.
Just keep going.
I assume that you're not the only person that would have laughed at that. I think that a lot of people that see them, like a lot of seamen, would actually laugh at sperm whales as well.
There you go. Fair enough.
I was just waiting for it.
Finish your thought, Adam.
Level 6, 7, and 8. Do you guys think that makes sense for the game design, that beasts stop being a legitimate threat to adventurers halfway through tier 2? Or should we have beasts that are even bigger and scarier?
I don't think so. And I say that because the main theme that we had with these beasts is that when you were fighting one of them, they're not that fantastical and difficult. But once you get into higher level, you're going to be dealing with their pack tactics, their groupings. Like, it's almost like when you encounter like one wolf, it's just a taste of what you're going to be fighting. But then you're not going to fight a pack of them until you're a little bit of a higher level. So you can adjust the tier level for these beasts depending on how many you have, like what the environment looks like, so on and so forth. So I don't think we need another level. I think there's enough there for us to play with as is.
Yeah, I think I agree with Megan. I think there's enough there. I think it takes away from the more fantastical creatures if we just keep making the beasts bigger and scarier. Yeah. The whole point is we're here because we're going beyond beasts, in my mind.
Exactly.
I agree 100%. You know, like, plants and fae are also pretty low level, but I mean, by the time that you're tier 3, you should be dealing with dragons and liches and shit beyond the natural world, even beyond the fantastical natural world, right? Yeah. These should be specific life-threatening events that are beyond just, we stumbled upon this creature, or we rode this creature, or whatever it was, right? So,
yeah, not wrong.
Anyway, that's all for this part of our discussion on beasts in D&D 5th edition. Please take a second to engage with the like, follow, comment, and review to help push our engagement. And don't forget to subscribe to find future inspirations for your campaigns.
If you'd like to support us, we have a store with some merch and a donate button on our website, www.itsamimic.com, as well as a Patreon. This episode and others can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and other most podcast apps. Thanks for listening to It's a Mimic, where you never know what you're going to get.
This has been an It's a Mimic production. Please check the show notes for this episode to see links, time codes, and credits. And don't forget to reach out and share your own inspirations.
Bye. Boom.
We did it. Nicely done,
Megan. That one wasn't easy, to be honest. That was a lot of bullet points, a lot of stuff to get through. It's those true. The easier episodes that the DM are like, here's Adam for 15 minutes. See you later.
Give us an info dump, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I watch y'all glaze over slowly and start napping in your chair. Yeah.
Thanks, Adam, for your nice calming voice, is what I'll say.
It's a long time to be sat down.
It's true. All right, team, but I do have to go. I have life to live. I have to.
Oh, all right. Yep.
Yeah. All right, guys.
Bye. Have a good one.
Bye.
I have nobody to impress in my life but myself. So if I ever have a kid, it's going to be for me. So we'll see what happens.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's the first thing that we say on this episode now.
Yeah.
There was no context for that whatsoever.
You're welcome, internet. I'll do it myself. That's just my slogan. I like how they were both talking about suits and weird animal skin suits. You're welcome.
Speaking if you're like a frog furry, what do they call you? Because you don't have fur. I don't want the answer. Do not come at me in the comments.
I'm skinny. Just... That feels wrong.
Ew. No.
A slimy.
You just
get covered in Vaseline slimy. And you're good to go.
Do you know what the sad thing is? It will be slimies, and they'll give themselves that name, which is the worst.
It'll be am furry.
Oh, God.
Because of amphibious.
Yeah, no, I'm
just making sure the
internet
got it.
That's the cold open, everyone. So. Megan's frozen. You guys are both frozen, right? So the reason I was just like not saying anything then is because I just had a still image of Megan like this, and her camera didn't come back. So I was like, I don't know what's happening. I was like, there just seems to be outrage.
So ugly.